the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing, subscribe to our podcast, leave us a lovely five-star review, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take back into your office to help protect your organization. Or maybe just find something interesting to talk about.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Yep. Now the FBI has software that can recognize faces but can't recognize crimes, like illegal search and seizure.
Well, it's just so much harder.
So the first article is the FBI tested facial recognition software on Americans for years, new documents show. And this comes to us from Gizmodo. So in a shocking announcement, the FBI and the Pentagon have been working on developing truly unconstrained facial recognition software that could potentially be deployed in drones, body cams, and other public cameras.
Any of the listeners to know that we debated several truly horrible jokes around truly unconstrained, and you should be very happy you didn't have to listen to any of them.
Yeah, maybe we should start a locals, and then people can get our dismissed jokes on Patreon or something.
The inappropriate ones that we didn't want to release. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You got to pay for those. Sure, that'll convince a lot of people. But unconstrained facial recognition, so that's seeing faces from not perfectly designed images, you know, not from like DMV photos or passports or stuff like that, but from images collected through other means. And IARPA, which actually started this whole thing, which is the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency, which was founded in 2006 and is of course, based on DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. They said that this is done by fusing information available from multiple views from diverse sensors and visual media.
I actually wondered how to pronounce that. I'd heard of DARPA, but not IARPA.
I'm guessing that's how it's pronounced.
YARPA, maybe? I don't know.
ARPA? Okay. See, you couldn't do it as just ARPA, because that's what DARPA used to be when it was the Army Advanced. But this, when it was being run out of IARPA, it had a code name of Janus. That's what the project name was.
That's imaginative.
Quite.
Yeah. That's such a great code name. I'm surprised nobody's done this before.
Yeah. They kind of messed up, though, because it goes from Janus in Greek mythology, then to Horus, which is Egyptian later. So they need to get their transitions correct. But this was started in 2014 by IARPA, which is headquartered in the University of Maryland Research Park, in the same building with NOAA, the USDA, and FDA. So it almost seems like these guys are trying to hide in some kind of out-of-way place, whereas DARPA has their own huge building in Arlington where they do their heinous stuff. Well, they don't do heinous stuff. They fund heinous stuff.
They would try to hide the illegal stuff they're doing. Or potentially illegal stuff, I guess.
Well, they're just diverting attention. You know, don't look over here. But when I looked up on their website, they had a couple of other interesting projects that they're working on. One called DIVA, Deep Intermodal Video Analytics, which aims to advance the state-of-art artificial visual perception and automate video monitoring. So that seems to go hand in hand with this. And then this other one, which was kind of weird, called Mosaic, which is the multimodal objective sensing to assess individuals with context program. That's where they come up with these acronyms and then try to shoehorn in some kind of phrase to go with it. But this one's
designed. That's how you're supposed to do it.
Yeah, that is. That's the American way for sure. But this program aims to develop unobtrusive, passive, and persistent measures to predict an individual's job performance. It designs and test sensors, which can collect data about monitoring employees' work performance. And it uses advances in mobile, wearable, and environmental sensors to develop continuous assessments of an individual's professional performance and physiological well-being throughout their career. Janus is not the only heinous thing that this place is doing.
Honestly, I'm kind of surprised that they're leading the way on this. I figured that private companies would be doing this way earlier than the government.
I think it's a cost benefit. I mean, the government's got basically unlimited funding to do whatever harebrained scheme comes their way. Whereas in a private organization, you'd have to say, well, this is going to definitely give us a return. Otherwise, it's just throwing away money. And this does not sound inexpensive to do.
That's fair. Yeah, I wonder what these sensors to like tell the physiological well-being, it almost have to include like a blood, like is it just a wearable measuring, you know, heartbeat and God, this is a smartwatch.
That's probably part of it. But it also mentioned questionnaires on their page, which will be linked in the show notes about it. But going back to the Janus program, so it officially ended in 2020 and was added into a facial recognition search tool called Horrid. But really, they shouldn't have said it ended so much as it finished. It didn't really end because they transitioned
their objectives.
Right. And then they transitioned this software to the DHS's Child Exploitation Investigations Unit.
Huh.
Yeah. So this still lives on. It's not like it's done.
So it's in a facial search tool. So I assume that this is doing the searching, doing the matching part.
Yeah, it doesn't discuss how they get the data to do the matching on, though.
Well, I mean, so they mentioned that the goal was to detect faces from partially obstructed angles from half a mile away was the goal of the project, which makes sense. Because again, like it's easier to do. A lot of times the face that you have to work from is like a driver's license photo or something like that. So it's a straight on shot with good lighting. Trying to match somebody that's looking away from you or like a 90-degree angle and weird lighting, like that's a tough one. So it makes sense that they were specifically trying to address that.
Well, they also mentioned wanting to process millions of searches at a time or million evaluations at a time. And you got to imagine that if they're detecting a face from a half a mile away, that image that's got that face a half mile away, it's got a lot of other data in it. Could be a lot of other people in there, not just that one face that's half a mile away. You're talking about like a huge dragnet of people being caught up in this kind of thing.
You just let AI do it.
Well, that's what they did. AI is the magical sauce in here. They didn't actually say how they came about how they made this successful, but undoubtedly they had some kind of AI machine learning stuff in there.
So obvious.
And of course, the ACL says, quote, "This is bullshit." Well, actually, that's not an actual quote.
It's like an Anchorman part where like he puts anything you put in the notes. But you know, if the ACLU could, this is something they're far more politic than that. But this
if they're as impolite as we are, that's exactly what they would have said.
So I found it interesting that they specifically called out looking at drones. Now, obviously, looking at drones in this day and age makes complete sense. But it's funny, like when you talk about the surveillance dragnet, most of the time you're talking about things like cameras in London that are attached to, you know, traffic lights and poles and stuff. But yes, they're always on, but they're always looking at the same area and you can dodge them and move them. But if you are using drones as your surveillance net, they can be deployed and moved. You never know whether this is almost like the panopticon where you never know if you're under surveillance or not at any time.
Right. And actually, they did a study of Palestinians and found that they're suffering from PTSD from almost a constant drone buzzing overhead over in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, because you don't know. Is it there to watch us? Is it there to drop a missile on us? What's it doing?
Right.
And yep, these aren't exactly Amazon delivery drones. These are freedom delivery drones.
That's what America does best is deliver freedom.
Yep. In 500-pound increments.
Yeah, but actually, you know what would be better than drones is blimps. So they actually have blimps deployed along the border. And those things, because they're just, you know, they're inflatable, they can stay on station almost indefinitely. Don't make any noise. And you can still retask them to look in different areas because you can move the camera around on the blimp. And depending on how you want to maintain the blimp in place, whether with a tether or a minimal engine to keep it in one place, you can have those things high enough up there, people really aren't going to see them or even notice them. And once they're up there for a while, even if they are within visual range, people will forget they're up there and not be paying any kind of attention.
It's like the opposite of the drones you were talking about in the West Bank.
Right.
Because it just stays up there. Yeah. And you probably don't even have to man it at all. You could just put a sensor package on there with a half a dozen cameras with extensive zoom lenses and, you know, an electronic warfare package.
Yeah, if you look at the blimps that they use on the southern border, they're like 30 to 50 feet. I'm sorry, 20 to 30 feet. They're not huge. So you're definitely not going to put any people on there. But because blimps are dropping bombs on people, also you don't get, generally don't get PTSD from that just being surveilled. But one never knows.
We'll probably put some sort of weapons delivery system on them too. Like put a missile pod or a rocket pod on there and just like you never use it, but you could if you wanted to drop a missile on someone or a gliding bomb or something.
Yeah, just in case.
Yeah, just in case. Never know when you're gonna see somebody crossing the Rio Grande and need to.
Yeah, that reminds me of the armed robots in, what was it, San Francisco we talked about a few weeks ago.
Yeah, just in case.
Just in case.
This is off topic, but it reminds me of the rods from heaven, like satellites with, the steel rods that get up to relativistic speeds.
Oh, right. Where is that in reference to?
It's a common trope in sci-fi novels about kinetic weapons from outside of the atmosphere.
Right. I'm trying to think about where I heard about them from. I can't remember. I think they had something like that in Daniel Schwartz's book, Freedom, I think.
I think they did. I think you're right. I think you did.
I don't think it was exactly rods, but it was something similar to that.
You know what? It may have been an
angel fire or something they called it.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, all right. Back to the article. Anyways, my only other comment on the drones thing is I find it so interesting that drones were, like, nobody discussed drones. I'm a huge sci-fi reader, and very rarely were drones discussed in sci-fi. Fascinating that we almost completely just missed that.
Well, except for Daniel Suarez, of course, who has a whole book on it.
Yeah, but that was, like, a couple years ago. Like, I'm talking...
Oh, you mean a long time ago, you mean?
Yeah, I'm talking... I've been reading sci-fi since I was, like, 10. And in 33 years of sci-fi, like drones have only popped up in the last 5 to 10 years. Like somehow all the sci-fi readers all just completely didn't think about it. Anyway, it's just weird. I just think it's strange. Anyways, so originally, apparently there were lines drawn in the project around what could be used domestically versus what would have been used internationally, because this was being operated by the DOD or a DOD agency. So ostensibly it would be used in, overseas conflicts. But how long would that really have lasted?
Probably about as long as that meeting did, because they're not going to constrain themselves by something like that. But at least, well, I don't know about at least, but local jurisdictions are better on this than state and federal are. As of now, there are at least 16 municipalities that have passed laws restricting the use of facial recognition by law enforcement. Whether this stops the feds or not, I'm skeptical, because I think in order to stop the feds, you'd actually have to ensure that the cameras were not present, because if they are, feds are going to find a way to start leveraging that data for sure.
Yeah, I went up and looked up some stats on how accurate facial recognition is. And in 2017, a test of several facial recognition technologies by NIST found that the accuracy in the real world was from 36% to 86%, with a median being 40%. 2022, the ACLU ran members of Congress through a facial recognition program and found that 28 members of Congress matched mugshots. They said it was false positives, but I don't know. That might be correct.
Well, maybe it just actually saw the future for where they should be. But according to the program documentation from IARPA, what they claim is that they achieved a performance goal of 85% verification accuracy at a false positive match of 1 in 100,000 and a 98% retrieval accuracy within the top 20 results from a 1 million subject gallery.
So a false match result of 1 in 100,000 doesn't sound bad. And this is kind of the false positive fallacy we've discussed before. If there's how many matches in New York City, which is a big city, what, like 8 million people? If each person gets on camera once per day, that would be 10 times 8, 80 false positives in a day. Now, I assume that they're only checking that. Or I wonder what they're checking it against. Because are all those false positives be mistakenly detected as bad guys, or they just be mistakenly detected as someone else? But then you also think about people are generally, you're caught on one camera on one block, and then you walk a block and you're caught on the next camera, then you walk a block and you're caught on the next camera. It's still a fair amount of false positives. So I imagine you probably see a couple thousand false positives a day.
Yeah, because I think one thing to think about here, like you just said about being caught on the camera multiple times, each one of those is a distinct image then. It's not as if that's one image of you to be a true or false positive against. That's 4 or 5 of you a day, or, in that instance, across different detection elements.
Yeah. So I think we have to get this down to a truly infinitesimally small false positive, right? You know what? Even then, we still have all the privacy concerns, even if the false positive rate is truly excellent.
So, well, even if it's zero, you don't want that.
Yeah. Yep. I'm letting myself get kind of distracted by the false positive. And honestly, that's not the part that matters.
You're just a government stooge. Just admit it.
Ah, you caught me.
But there are places that are already doing facial recognition anyway, outside of the government. Casinos, retailers, airlines are doing it when you go through the boarding procedure.
I was kind of surprised at that one. I didn't know about that one.
And apparently Detroit and Chicago PDs are supposedly doing it. Maybe they're trying to get their gun crime down because obviously the gun laws haven't done it.
It's already illegal to kill somebody with a gun. What else do you need? So there are a bunch of constitutional issues that mostly center around the 14th Amendment, although I've also seen a couple other ones cited. The Supreme Court ruled the other year that putting a GPS tracking device on a car was to be considered a search due to the ability to, quote, monitor and catalog every single movement of an individual, end quote.
You might want to do that again. You said the 14th Amendment rather than the Fourth Amendment.
So there are constitutional issues. The one quoted most often is the Fourth Amendment, although I have heard some other ones mentioned in relation to this. The only one I could find definitive information on was Fourth. So recently, the Supreme Court ruled that putting a GPS tracking device on a car was a search due to the ability to, quote, monitor and catalog every single movement of an individual, end quote. A comprehensive network of cameras would kind of do the same thing if you could track and watch somebody as they left their apartment, walked to work, you know, went to all their other places. Although I do have a question, if single separated cameras or cameras around only specific areas would therefore trigger the Fourth Amendment concern. I think that if they were separated widely enough where you couldn't actually track someone, but then it wouldn't be as useful to law enforcement.
Now, I think it's the stitching together that would make it wrong. That would be the offense.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think that just having the facial recognition wouldn't trigger a Supreme Court level of protection here.
Right. I mean, it used to be that if you wanted to follow someone, you had to spend considerable resources to do so, which limited the amount of following that was going on. So this kind of thing lowers that bar to near zero. So they can follow anyone as often or as long as they want without needing to spend a whole lot of resources on it.
How convenient.
Well, it's also convenient in that as long as these things are recording, then not only do you see what they're currently doing, you get to see what they did by tracking them back through the past also.
Yeah, I mean, that would make things so much simpler for, you know, police. They could just go back and see where the crook was and watch them commit their crime on camera.
Right. Yeah, that's I'm certain that's the way it would. But imagine if the cops started using this like threat hunting. Well, they said, well, if someone was here and then here, then they're probably doing bad stuff. So let's get an arrest warrant or let's get a warrant to search our house or let's do something else like that. Or they take the pattern of one criminal and they try to apply that pattern to someone else. Say, hey, this is Bob. Before he robbed this liquor store, he was here and here. So if anybody else does those same three things or is in those same three places, then let's assume that they're also going to commit a crime and let's get them out of time. So you end up with, you know, pre-crime and things of that nature as well. So this sets a terrible precedence for this. And at least if hopefully this stuff that's happening at the municipal level will start boiling up to larger jurisdictions and maybe just get rid of cameras altogether. But actually, I didn't do additional research on this, but this just reminded me of the whole concept of the smart city. And in the concept of the smart city, you have to have cameras everywhere for the smart city concept. So that's something else that's pushing us towards even greater and greater surveillance. You know, just like, I mean, 1984 didn't have anything on the way the United States is today.
I actually think that we're less 1984 and more Brave New World than.
I think it's a mix.
Which dystopia are we?
Yeah, well, at least we're not to Hunger Games yet.
Yeah, could be worse. Could be worse. All right, so why does this matter? Well, stripping away more and more rights over time, unless we push back consistently.
Yeah, of course, you could always just go and get your Guy Fawkes mask out of the closet.
You know, I actually, weirdly enough, I logged into Twitter, and the very first thing I saw pop up is adversarial fashion. Someone who am I following? Oh, Ava. I can't remember her last name, but I think she works at the FF. Yeah. Her first thing she said was she just got her sweatshirt from Adversarial Fashion. And it's about fashion to defeat surveillance. It's got like, they've got like a hoodie that has a whole bunch of circuits and license plates on it. They've just got all kinds of stuff to like mess with automatic recognition. So this is kind of cool.
Interesting.
I may pick up one or two of these. I think I like this. And they should sponsor us.
But I mean, does this work or does it just look like it would work?
Well, I guess the question is, what is it? What are you trying to do with it? It is going to give a bunch of weird data points in any kind of surveillance thing that is automatically trying to pull data and search for data. But I don't think it's not going to prevent them from telling who you are. Like, it's not.
Right.
So this is more of a political thing.
Yeah, I remember years ago when the facial recognition stuff really started getting big, there was this idea about painting certain designs on your face.
Yeah, like the World War II camouflage.
I don't know. I remember like triangles and stuff in order to mess up the facial recognition.
Yeah. Hold on. Camouflage, face paint, visual. All right. I did not. No, but there's a name. All right.
You can also start handing out paintball guns.
I searched for face pain. That was not, got weird results.
Not quite right.
Oh, dazzle. That's it. Dazzle camouflage.
Oh, right. Yep.
Yeah. Apparently it only tricks older stuff. It doesn't trick newer stuff.
Right.
Because I saw a hoodie. Maybe we talked about this. Did we talk about the hoodie with the IR lights?
No, I don't.
Maybe it must have been at work. There's a hoodie that has little IR lights down near kind of the lapel. So when you put up the hood, they're by your face. And it flickers like IR lights, which if you're caught on a night vision camera that's using IR for the camera, it blinds the camera.
Oh, that's a pretty good idea.
So it is. Yeah, it is kind of cool, except for it like flickers. So like I'm looking at it, I'm like, all right, so in between the flickers, you can still see who this is, bud. Good try.
Probably does that to save battery, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, it was cool. Anyways, so for our next article, we're going to talk AI because we're slowly becoming an AI podcast. We had our crypto phase for a while. Now we're doing AI for a couple months, and then something else cool will come up. This is from Daniel Meisler talking about SPQA, the AI-based architecture that'll replace most existing software. So Mr. Meisler begins that AI is going to start moving software from a circuit-based model to an understanding-based model, and SPQA stands for state, policy, questions, and action.
And that's not to be confused with SPQR, which is an abbreviation for the Senate and People of Rome.
Practically the same thing. So he gives a number of examples of how it's going to transition from circuit-based to understanding-based, but I pulled out a couple of interesting ones here. The big one, I think, the two big ones, well, three big ones, whatever. They are all around increased flexibility. No one expects the Spanish Inquisition. Surprise is our chief or whatever.
Comfy chairs.
Inputs. Moving from rigid and explicit to natural language inputs. And we discussed this when we discussed how SOAR could be improved by AI. And I still have a blog post I need to write about how it's going to, given that I work a lot in SOAR right now, that's one of the big pain points in SOAR and in SIM for that matter. About how rigid the input is. And if something does not match exactly what's expected, everything just breaks. And the second one's related, data, moving from structured data to dynamic data. And this would be such an incredible boon for SIM because normalizing data is such a consistent issue, especially over time when your data changes formats. Like Microsoft recently changed their source type for their data feed. So frustrating. Your stuff just stops working and you're like, wait, what? What happened here?
Number three.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying that's awesome. No, you'd like, if vendors are going to do that, you'd like them to have like that be the top of the README file or something like that when they do that kind of stuff.
So you just have to find out after it breaks. I'm sure it was the top of the README file, but then the README file wasn't going to the SIM engineer. Mm-hmm. Like it probably our, you know, Office 365 administrator got it and then was like, all right, that's cool. Doesn't affect me.
That was awful polite of him to let you know.
Whatever. Third one is output static to linked. Although I don't know that I agree with linked here. I think it's really static to dynamic. I think it's basically the same as the previous two. where you can change the output to be whatever you need it to be, again, rather than having to write parsers or write methods to explicitly create data, you know, in X columns. That all comes down to increased flexibility. So the architecture itself, I'll talk about each of the individual pieces. SPQA, state, policy, questions, actions. State. The state is all data for the model that feeds it about your current state. And this could be a custom AI model that's built around your own logs, emails, business data, employee information, etc. Or more likely, it'll be what he talked about before, where you're taking a generic model like ChatGPT or Google's Bard, and then you're overlaying your own custom information on top of it. The second model is policy.
Well, hold on a second. So it's first state. You know, I wonder if you'd run into problems there if the data is incomplete. Because the way that I was reading through this, it seems like, you know, you have to give it all the things in order for it to answer all your questions that you want. So I wonder how far off base this would end up going if the data set you gave it would be incomplete. Or because what I'm thinking of is, you know, when you ask ChatGPT a question, it doesn't say, I don't know. That's not one of its answers, right? It will say something, even though it might be wrong. It's going to give you an answer. So if you have an incomplete amount of data provided to your model here to tell it what your state is, it's not going to say inefficient data, or not inefficient data, but
efficient data.
Yeah. Insufficient data. It's going to give you an answer that's just bad.
Yeah. No, you're right. And I feel like that's a weakness that's going to have to be incorporated into the model somehow. You're going to need some way to tell when it can't answer your question well.
So I think one of the things that he's also assuming when he goes through this is that, let's say you do give it everything, right? There's literally no stone you don't unturn in providing it to the model. What if that's still not enough?
How do you tell?
Yeah. How do you tell? You know, maybe you haven't had conversations you need to have. Maybe you haven't had email exchanges or, you know, meetings, or you don't have an application that's going to provide you with this data, or, you know what I'm trying to say is that just because you give it everything you have doesn't mean that it is everything you need to give it.
Yeah. So step two is policy. And this one has similar issues. The policy is what you're trying to achieve. And this is a custom AI model that's built around your vision, your mission, your goals, your risks, your strategies. And that's kind of the same thing. Like, what if your goals are the wrong goals? An AI might tell you, like, your goal is to dominate a specific niche in the security tools market. And the AI gives you a great way to get there, but it turns out that's a dying niche.
Actually, you know what this just made me think of is a SWOT analysis. So strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. If, you know, part of what you'd probably want to feed into this also is everything you can possibly provide it about your competition, is what they're doing and what they're not doing, so that you can have a relativistic picture of where you should go as well compared to where they're at or where they look like they're going.
Yeah. Would be interesting.
And which will also be incomplete data because you don't know everything about them unless you have someone on the inside that's stealing all their stuff.
Well, that's assuming they have all the data.
Yeah. We're going to start chasing that tail.
You know what, though? That sounds like what that sounds like is that sounds like we need to be doing we, like I'm, you know, working on AI myself, but it sounds like someone needs to be doing that research to figure out when and how it's making a bad decision, if that's even possible. But anyways, that's what we're talking
about.
That's
a problem for Tyler.
That's a problem, Tyler. Yeah, all these other smart folks. All right, questions. What you ask the model based on the state and policy. You have the state, which is your current state, your policy, which is where you want to go and how you want to get there. And then you can ask questions. And this part is purely human-based. And he gives some examples, like, how do we acquire more customers? What is the greatest risk to our company? What's the most appropriate org structure to maximize growth? And this one's kind of horrifying, because this is like taking the MBA model. Like, what if you ask it the best way to maximize growth and it's like, cut 80% of the people? And like, do you just blindly follow it?
Well, imagine if a competitor gets in and compromises your model and says, and you say, you ask it, what should we do? And it says, kill yourself.
Well, I mean, they obviously wouldn't follow that because, but I could see like making some real. Because we've talked before about how a lot of AI folks say we don't really understand what's going on inside these models and we can't tell how it makes its decision. So yeah, I could see some weirdness where it tells you to do something weird and you do it and it works out well. And you just start blindly believing the AI.
And then you have an industrial espionage case where someone is, you know, compromises your model intentionally.
Yeah. And they don't. And what's interesting about that is they don't have to tell you something really obvious, like you mentioned. It can be something like decrease the quality of your products to save money. Something that kind of sounds like it might make some sense.
Well, I don't know. I think they would have to do that even more subtle than that. Say, swap this component for this component, which causes an increased failure rate or makes it less resilient and break faster, or you know what I mean? Which causes you to lose customers because your quality isn't as good.
Yeah, and the other company will know where to hit you. They're like, all right, so we know that, you know, Joe Bob's tools are going to start being worse and less durable because, you know, we poisoned their model. And then they can start hammering them on that.
Yeah, a lot of fun can be had here.
It's true. All right. So he has a short aside on whether or not AIs actually understand. His example here is a love poem between Luke and Leia. He's not claiming consciousness or feeling, just understanding.
Yeah, I'm skeptical. That's understanding, the way he put it. I mean, there's nothing Star Wars-y in the poem. It's just her name. I think he wanted to interpret it as understanding. The fact that it's, you know, the poem's about forbidden love. I mean, Romeo and Juliet was forbidden, but that, you know, gives no indication of the context. There's nothing Star Wars-y in there at all. There's no context to the rebellion, the Force, or Han Solo. I mean, I could buy that there was understanding here if maybe he asked for similar poems with different characters in Star Wars or even in different movies to see if it actually understood the context of those people. I don't think so. I think what he asked for was a generic poem, and that's what he got out with Leia's name in it.
So
I'm skeptical about that.
I'd say this demonstrates a similar level of understanding to most middle schoolers and probably more skill at developing poems than most middle schoolers.
Well, maybe. I mean, he assumes that it has some kind of context, though, when it could have simply been a poem where, you know, someone else asks a similar question and he just switches the names out and gives you the same poem. I don't know.
Yeah. That's fair.
So like I said, I would have liked to seen that run half a dozen times, you know, ask the same question with Han Solo and see how the poem changes.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Huh. All right. So he does provide a example, a biotech company with 12,000 employees hires a new CISO. As always, you know, the new CISO comes in and they want a whole bunch of data and information about what's going on in the environment. So they ask for a list of the most critical applications ranked by business importance and risk. They want a prioritized list of top threats to them and the corresponding security spend, both in time and money. They want recommendations on adjusting budget, headcount, OKRs, and project lists to align with those threats. Then they want to rewrite the security strategy to reflect, define the top 5 KPIs to track progress, and update a presentation for the board. Finally, create a full implementation plan for the next year and a quarterly report to tell the board how well things are going.
Easy peasy.
Yeah, nothing. This could take months, if not years. A list of the most critical applications, the top threats, how much it's going to cost and how to protect them, and then rewrite everything and present it. Oh my gosh. This would put all the managers in the group into constant meetings for the next, you know, 3 months while they have somebody else do the work and write down all the things.
And meanwhile, the real work's not getting done because you dirtied resources to answer all these questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So now he's
not to say that they're not important questions, mind you. But you know, not easy. You have to consider resource constraints.
Yeah. So he hypothesized the same thing, but using an SPQA tool. You choose your base model. For example, it could be a public one like ChatGPT. Or I'm sure in the future, there'll probably be specialized ones created by security or consulting companies based on, you know, there'll probably be like a McKinsey model that'll, you know, focus things in towards the way that they think it should go.
No, that would be the best model.
Or even on a single person. Like I could see there being like a Bruce Schneier security model. Like if you think that his view on how security should go is the best one. Although I recently saw an article talking about how to improve your prompt, your AI query prompts. And one of the things that I saw that was interesting was telling the prompt to assume a persona will change the voice of the results. Like if you have a particular economist you want to do the analysis, you can say like, assume you are Milton Friedman and then give it the question. So this would probably actually be a modifier where you could say, you know, I want to use the McKenzie data model, but write it as Bruchschneier. Then you would need to train the custom layer of the model on your own data. You would need to train a policy model on your documentation. And you'd ask it your questions, and then it would spit out, you know, a plan where you could review and revise the results. And in his interpretation of this, he thinks this will take minutes. I would disagree. Training a custom model takes a lot of time, depending on your horsepower and the size of your data. I found an example online for training data on a 5 gigabyte data set using AWS servers. It ranged from 6 to 250 hours based on the size of the server you used, although, weirdly enough, the cost was roughly equal, at least within an order of magnitude, because the less powerful servers cost less. So even though it took many times longer to ingest and process the data, it cost between $5 and $8. So that was not bad.
Yeah, and I think he was actually suggesting that this would be like 350 terabytes, I think.
Did he say that somewhere in there?
Yeah, like, I think that was his rough estimate of, okay, you give it everything, it's going to be 350 terabytes, and you know it's going to spit out your data in minutes.
Yeah, that's like minutes. That's no problem. And I think that the biggest issue is the policy part. Whenever there's a leadership change, the policy part tends to end up being partially rewritten. That could take weeks. Anyways, finally, you need to review the output and make sure things worked out. As David mentioned before, AI, well, there's two things here. First of all, if the AI doesn't know what to do, it's going to spit out well-written BS. The second thing is that AI models we've seen have been very sensitive to inputs. So if you change your input slightly, you may get wildly different recommendations too. You probably have to run this 5 or 6 or 7 times and compare the outputs.
Well, then how do you pick the output then?
Well, you pick the one that matches what your CISO wanted to do anyways. Or that you wanted to do and be like, well, the AI says this is what we have to do.
Right. So you keep tweaking your question until you get the output you want, and then you take that one to the CISO.
I mean,
hey, look what I got.
Isn't that kind of what happens every time we have an advance? Like, we just end up... Anyways, so I still think this will be a huge improvement. I think we're going to be talking about improvements from months or years down to, you know, 1 month or 2 months. I do think the quarterly updates will be very fast.
Yeah, once you're just talking about like a diff or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think, you know, one of the things, like I said, that he's not including here, I think that you're going to have to definitely include is outside data that's not about your organization. You're going to have information about the market, customers, you know, competitors, things of that nature. Like I said, basically kind of do a SWOT analysis and feed it in.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then he also has a bunch of other interesting scenarios where this could be applied, like finding attackers in the network. I could see doing something like that. You have an external data model from, you know, Mandiant about here's all the ways we've seen attackers compromise a network. And then you layer over the top of it the behavior in your network of what's actually happening. And then you can have it flag and pull out kind of, you know, we've seen this behavior all related to this IP address. Although that doesn't seem that much more advanced than risk-based alerting, other than maybe like sorting through it faster than, I mean, that'd basically be like downloading a custom rule set.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to see it in action.
Yeah, kind of the same thing. Like he talks about automatically responding to attacks by disabling accounts, isolating systems. Like I don't see how that's that much better than a really good automation product. But I guess the question is the answer is in the flexibility of the tool.
Yeah, because he's assuming it's going to make human-like decisions, because that's the point of having a person look at stuff is saying they'll put their own judgment or their own knowledge on it and say, oh, this is definitely bad or this is most likely not bad because of this other thing I understand personally. So, I mean, I think the possibility is there. I'm skeptical about how fast we're going to get there. I think he thinks it's going to be like 5 years away, I think, is what he was saying.
Yeah. So why does this matter? Well, I think if this is the future, it's going to change almost everything about what we do and how we do it. And what I find really interesting, though, is where it is automating and where it is simplifying is in the management realm. This is not, you know, saying that it's going to, you know, get rid of the network engineers and the analysts, and although those are places that are definitely potentially sensitive to this. I just find it a little interesting that he's hypothesizing this. And this reminds me of a book I read several years ago. But I can't remember. I went looking for the name and I could not find it. But in this book, the AI replaced the managers first. So what they found was that this was related to the service industry, and it's difficult to create a robot. We still haven't managed to create like a really good robot that can manipulate things as good as a hand, but we managed to come up with you know, narrowly trained AI that can write better than most high schoolers. And in this book, the AI effectively took over the management positions in retail stores. So like, you know, you can tell, all right, you know, on a normal day, we have our spikes in number of people that come in here. They typically need help in these areas. We need to make sure that the bathrooms are cleaned every hour. Like a lot of what goes on in retail and service industry is very formulaic. So the AI in that was basically just managing the store. You know, we need X people on this date. You need to, you know, make sure we're making sales of this much, you know, track. This is, it goes back to what we were talking about before, tracking the fizzy, track where everybody is in the store and make sure they're interacting with customers. You know, ping people to go clean the bathroom every hour, stuff like that. That's very easy for a computer program to do. On another note, though, I was actually listening to a Freakonomics podcast about the benefit of good managers. And it was really interesting because they found that a bad manager only reduces the productivity of the team by something like 10%. The value of a good manager and the negative of a bad manager is not in the productivity. It's in retention. A bad manager or a good manager can increase retention by like 30 to 40%.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's not the way it's couched in the, was that Google book?
The one by Laszlo Zand or whatever?
Yeah, something to work. Work rules.
Yeah. Well, but the way he phrases it is the most important thing that a manager can do, can hire, is hiring the right people, which I don't think that this study measured. This study was not measuring like hiring the correct people.
I mean, that's part of what he talks about. But he also talks about how the force multiplier of a good manager, and he makes a relatively big deal about it from what I remember from that book also.
I read that book, but I don't recall that specifically on there. I was just going with a podcast that I heard recently. They had an economist on who had apparently studied the impact of good versus bad managers.
Well, I'm not saying that Laszlo is right over an economist.
Well, I think that a manager probably wants to think that they're a force multiplier.
Such as himself.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? I mean, you probably want to think that, oh, nothing would get done if I wasn't here. But you see that all the time where managers leave and the team continues on and still gets the work done.
Right. And that's one of the disappointing things that I've seen for, well, I don't know. It's disappointing to me. I don't know if it's disappointing necessarily for the place that I've been. But I'll go someplace and I'll work on implementing some process or procedure or something like that. And then I will leave and then I'll talk to people who are still there and they're like, oh, we don't do that anymore. Threw it all out.
Yeah. We're all just replaceable cogs. All right. On to, we talked maybe for too long about that one. Two short ones left.
All right. So the next article is the role of customer service in cybersecurity. So, well, when Matt and I initially looked at the headline for this article, we thought it was one thing and it turned out to be something different. So we thought this was going to be the necessity for customer service in cybersecurity. You know, how cybersecurity works with customers and other parts of the organization. But it turns out that this article is actually about customer service people in an organization and the threat posed to them in a cybersecurity context. So they point out that customer service is frequently the face of the company. So they interact with the customers a lot. If anyone's going to interact with it with an organization, it's going to be through these people primarily. And they're expected to do a lot of different things as part of these interactions. Answer questions, provide information, take actions on behalf of the customers. And they'll do this through a variety of communication mechanisms, social media, email, chat, phone, text. There's probably others that I can't think of off the top of my head. And all this kind of poses what I would say is a pretty big attack surface for attackers. And I think this is something that a lot of organizations, I don't know, they get it wrong or they think of the customer service people in a different context as if they're like low-level employees and aren't terribly important. But I would contradict that by saying that these are some of the most important people from and not just to the organization itself, but from a cybersecurity perspective as well, because of what they're expected to do and the access that they have to do what is necessary, as well as the attack service that they present to the outside world. So I think cybersecurity should be taking more stock of these people and interacting in a much greater context than they have been in the past with these folks. And the challenge here is that there is a high turnover. They should be well-trained and treated like they're as important to the company as they are. But because of the high turnover rate in these kinds of roles, it's really difficult to do that. So what I would say is something that you might want to consider doing is either have one of your cybersecurity people try to do that job or go in and shadow someone in the customer service, on this customer service team, so that you know what they do and how they do it. And when you understand that, you might have a better concept about how you could possibly protect them from attackers, as well as maybe help them streamline their work from a security perspective to eliminate risks and improve performance.
That would be interesting to see a cybersecurity person go in and do the customer service for. I'd pay money to see that, I think.
Yeah, you'd have to have a supervisor watching them for sure.
Yep. They go crazy and they're like, I'm not doing this. Screw you. For our last article, we have journalists hurt by exploding USB bomb drive. 4 media outlets in South America. I didn't write down the country. Shame on me.
Ecuador.
4 media outlets in Ecuador received exploding USB devices, and one of them was injured when they plugged it in and it exploded. The assumption is that the electricity from plugging it in set it off. Only half the charge apparently went off, and the journalist received minor injuries.
Yeah, he's lucky. I mean, something like that could have taken his hand off.
Yep. Maybe that was the point, actually. Journalists, although they ignore you can do text-to-speech now, so it's not the end of the world.
I think it's more of intimidation than it was actual wanting to take him out of commission.
That makes sense. So, discussion points. InfoSec folks have always said, don't just plug in USB drives. If you really need another reason on why you shouldn't plug in USB drives, this is a good one.
Well, not only that, but don't plug it in with it. You get it through the mail. These were sent through the mail, and the guy said, oh, and just plugged it in. They got it through the, you know, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, but wasn't there a threatening letter with the USB drive?
Oh my gosh. I have no idea about that. I'd be like, why? Why did you do this? Why did you plug this in? That's
little lack of common sense there also.
A little bit. In 2018, Hack5 demonstrated how to do this as a proof of concept. I think that they're responsible for this. Hack5 did it.
Yeah, absolutely. They should be sued and go to jail.
The assumption is this is terrorism rather than murder. The charges were apparently pretty small, or maybe gang-related violence. It is. But again, this is less... Like, you get it, and you're like, all right, I'm not going to plug it in.
I don't know. I was actually should have taken additional time on this one to see what the political situation is and what this guy's beat was, what he was reporting on. Because they mentioned in the article that it was military-grade Semtex.
Yeah, they did.
That was in the USB. So it's
difficult for most people to get a handhold on.
You would think that would be challenging for people to do that.
You'd be wrong. They do it on TV all the time.
Yep. I mean, if a private person can get a Polish yacht and scuba dive down 250 feet and blow up 4 pipelines, I'm sure just a regular joke.
Is that
joke
the latest thing going around that it was a...
Oh, you haven't seen that? The New York Times article?
No.
Yeah, apparently they supposedly six people, 5 men and a woman, rented a Polish yacht. They were Ukrainians, but not affiliated with the government. Rented a Polish yacht, went out to the Baltic Sea. Scuba dive down, planted, I think they said it was about somewhere between 500 and 1,000 pounds of explosives on the pipelines, and then detonated it. This is not done by the CIA and the Navy.
Huh. Well, shocking. So anyways, back to this. So does this matter? Not unless you're, you know, pissing off people with access to explosives.
No, but if you didn't need another reason not to plug in a USB drive, I think this is a good reason not to.
It could explode. Yeah. Yeah. That seems like a good reason not to.
And it's not like a vape pen.
So what should you do about it? I think this would be hilarious to build a smoke bomb USB drive and prank your users. Right. I see no way this could go wrong.
Disclaimer, we don't condone the use of explosives in USB drives.
Yeah, you would definitely get fired, I think, for doing that. And it might be worth a reminder about USB malware and not plugging in strange USBs. I am still consistently shocked with the amount of USB malware that's out there. I would have thought that's something that we had licked literally a decade ago.
And they had that on an episode of Mr. Robot just a couple of years ago.
It kills me. It's ridiculous.
You tell them, Matt.
I will. Ridiculous. All right. Well, thanks for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter @SerengetiSec and subscribe and listen on your favorite podcast app.